Welcome again to Mormon Land, the Salt Lake Tribune's podcast about LDS teachings and culture. I'm Dave Noyce. I'm a managing editor and religion editor here at the Tribune. I'm here with our senior religion reporter, Peggy Fletcher Stack. Hello again, Peggy.
Hi, Dave.
Well, the Mormon Church finds itself in the headlines with recent revelations that a former president of the Missionary Training Center has been accused of sexual misconduct with female missionaries in the 1980s. The church has also issued new guidelines for its lay leaders when interviewing members and counseling abuse victims. Here to discuss those issues with us is Jennifer Finlayson Fife, a Mormon herself and a licensed therapist who specializes in working with LDS couples and sexuality and relationship issues. She joins us by phone from Chicago. Dr. Finlayson Fife, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Great. Well, let's start with just a general reaction question. What was your response when you heard about the recent MTC case?
My response was dismay and distress and disgust. All B words.
So do you think that the LDS Church would do anything differently today? Apparently nothing was done about him at the time. The victim said she told her singles ward bishop, but he didn't believe her he says he told no one about it. What do you think would happen today if a sister missionary came forward and said her MTC president had sexually abused her?
Well, it probably depends a little bit on how informed that particular bishop is. I do think the culture is starting to shift, which is a very good thing. I mean, despite all of the negative reaction that I had to the news, the silver lining, of course, is that it punctuates a problem, a cultural problem that we have in the church that needs to be addressed. And so I think it is pressuring some systemic shifts, as well as more credibility being given to victims that I think bishops would be more likely to attend to now than they may have been a couple decades ago or even a couple years ago.
So what would be some of those red flags the Mormon leader should be looking for short of a confession? I mean, so besides a victim coming forward, are there some red flags that people should be looking for in their congregations? What do you think? What would you advise?
It depends a bit on the age of the person that they're talking to. Mm-hmm. If it's a child, it's a little hard to know, but children are seldom going to talk about abuse unless they feel really clear that they will be protected in talking about it. And so a lot of times kids are, it's a tricky question to answer because you'll track a lot of anxiety in kids who have tolerated some level of abuse. And depending on whether it's happening in their family or not, the likelihood of them speaking up. I think the thing that's tricky about talking to adults and even young adults is oftentimes women in particular are in coercive situations that they will take responsibility for because the culture often pushes us to do that. And won't recognize the coercion that's been involved in their decisions or their experience. And oftentimes bishops will see that as a kind of consensual act when really it was a power differential that was happening. So I think bishops and anybody that's in a pastoral position needs to really understand the power dynamics that are at play when victims are vulnerable, when victims are in an assault situation, and to understand the reluctance or sometimes even the lack of clarity around what happened to them and whether or not they hold a role in it. Oftentimes victims feel like they somehow brought it onto themselves, and it's easy to not track that in those conversations or even in those admissions of some kind of sin.
So this week, the First Presidency announced revised guidelines for bishop interviews. Among the changes was allowing those to be interviewed to invite another adult besides the bishop into the conversation. What do you think about the revisions that were made?
I think that's an excellent first start. I think that it's something I've suggested for a long time, that always you should feel comfortable having anyone else in the room at any time, just like in a gynecological exam, you know, that you can always have another adult there. I think it's a great start, and I think it's a great acknowledgement by the church that there is a problem and there is some inherent vulnerability in an adult male being with any woman or minor in the room. I think that it doesn't go far enough, though, because I think often the people that are the least vulnerable would be the ones that would ask for someone else to be there, because they're able to kind of hold on to their own sense of their rights, so to speak, and their ability to advocate for themselves would be high. And those that are less able to advocate for themselves or who feel a lot of pressure to defer to authority would be those most vulnerable to abuse and least likely to ask for someone to be there. So I think it needs to be more of a given that either we're not having these kinds of worthiness interviews that are one-on-one in with minors and seniors, or that we always have another adult present, or, you know, even a basic start, although it doesn't make us invulnerable, because assault can, of course, happen male to male or female to female, but at least starting with girls and women talking to women and boys and men talking to men.
What about, one of the things that's been raised about this is that perhaps if it's a young person, say being abused by a parent, or the parent manipulating to be in on the interview too.
Yes, right. That's very tricky. I agree with that completely. I know situations in which the parent would insert themselves into the interview in order to prevent the child from talking about the fact that the father was molesting her and her sisters. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't coming from the child. It was coming very much from the father to maintain his own privacy around what he was doing. So that's definitely a problem in that arrangement. And, you know, so absolutely. I think that it's just a tricky business mm-hmm. that the church is putting itself in to be asking these kinds of questions of youth and being so ill-prepared in terms of their own training.
So is there any downside to having, it does seem like there's kind of there can be nice one-on-one interviews. Two-on-one, are there any downsides to that? It just seems in some ways awkward.
Yes, exactly. I was thinking it as I was thinking about what that would be like. You have two adults and one child. It's very different than if, I agree, it's not an easy solution. It's one thing if the teenager or someone is saying, I would like it if my sister is here, or I would like it if my young women's president is with me, because she has an ally in that conversation. That feels very different than we have a rule where now you're gonna have two adults in the room with you while you confess something. That's a very different meaning and dynamic, and therefore effect. So
it doesn't seem clear to me that it requiring there always to be two seems a little strong. Right. But then some people are definitely calling for that, and I
understand, and I think that. I do think one way to mitigate some of the risk right away is to just do same-sex conversations. There's no reason why young women's president couldn't be someone to have conversations with any of her young women about concerns they're having or anything that they feel. And then if they felt like they needed some kind of a priesthood intervention, I don't know if that's the right word, but response, then maybe she and that young woman could go and have a conversation with the bishop, and that's more of an active alliance. But, you know, it's all these proposed solutions have their vulnerabilities, because even then the young women's president could pressure her to go talk to the bishop, and then she does have two people.
Right.
It's no longer an act of, I'm all for people being able to go and confess or talk about something or get input around something that is distressing them, concerning them. We need that. We need a community that protects and can be an additional resource to the well-being of the membership than just the parents. That's necessary. But when they are sort of pressured confessions and worthiness interviews, it already sets up a very different meaning frame and dynamic. And so if these were elective conversations, then it's a very different thing that you want to go talk to the bishop, and then maybe you choose someone that you want to have join you in that conversation. Very different dynamic than you need to be here on Sunday at 1 o'clock for a conversation. And there's going to be two of us. That's a very different kind of meaning.
So should the Mormon Church just do away with worthiness interviews and just reserve those interviews for people who want to seek the bishop out for either confessional or counseling or something like that?
Well, I certainly think there's a strong theological context for doing it exactly the way that you say. I mean, I think compulsory confessions and kind of judgments are a little bit of a, at least in my view, a social control mechanism more than something that really helps people progress. And I think it's more around, you know, the privileges of a recommend or advancement in the priesthood that maybe pressure compliance. But that's, compliance is not, in my mind, highly linked to our evolution and development, meaning not compliance that's pressured out of social stigma. I'm not sure that it is as valuable in terms of our development into ethical, loving beings that I think faith is intended to create in us. I'm not sure that that has any value.
What if there were some annual interviews with young people or temple recommend interviews, but the questions were different, less sexually probing, more self-evaluating. How do you feel, brother or sister so-and-so, about yourself, and are there issues? In other words,
I think that's an excellent idea. I mean, so I can... Exactly. I think it's somewhat the quality of the questions that are problematic. They're very much have a sexual orientation because we care very much about sexual purity. I also think they're more around demonstration of belief and compliance rather than more self-reflective and helping people in their own integrity and their own where they're challenging themselves to grow and to become better. I think those kinds of conversations could be very valuable.
So do you have any, let's just say that the interviews continue as they are and a young person wants to go into it alone without a second adult. It seems like, how would you prepare young people if the bishop starts asking inappropriate questions?
I think one way to do that is to have those questions be well known to the membership. So here are the questions that the bishop will ask you. Be prepared. These are the questions you will answer. And the bishop shouldn't go off script. I mean, he shouldn't be asking questions that are probing or, you know, asking for specifics. And you can certainly bring to his attention anything that you feel you would like to talk about. And you can certainly say, I would like guidance and help around this aspect or something that's going on in my life. And you can bring that to him. if he asks you questions about that, you certainly can answer any of those questions, but you also have the right to not answer them. You don't have to answer any question that's asked. The bigger challenge is the cultural reality that this MPC case speaks to, and lots of the abuses that have happened in these contexts, is that we are taught at an early age that our leaders are called of God, that they are a mouthpiece for God, that deference to them is a measure and mechanism of worthiness. And so it's not just, okay, here's the questions, and, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that has no value, but you're also looking at a larger cultural dynamic and system in which you are taught that self-doubt and deference is a part of your goodness, and especially true female to male. So there's just so much pressure on that young woman to answer as she is asked. She really has a family culture that tells her otherwise.
That's a question I have. Certainly there are bishops who do exactly what you said. They say they tell all the young people with their parents sometimes. We've interviewed them that say, this is what I'll be asking. This is the limits of what I'll be asking, but certainly not all bishops do that.
Yes.
I mean, how would, I don't think most Mormon young people or adults even know they have a right not to answer a question. And how would the bishop react if you don't answer the question? You know, say, I'm not going to answer that question.
Yes, I think, you know, again, depending on how enlightened the bishop is, and, you know, obviously there's a lot of really good bishops who want to just serve their flock well, and would tolerate that kind of pushback. I think others would, you know, demean it as a faithless act to not be willing to answer a question that they're being asked. So again, it speaks to that cultural issue that hierarchy and compliance are sort of the essentials in spiritual goodness versus a model that's more around collaboration and the strength in both leadership and its members working together to become stronger, better people. It's a different model, in my opinion, one that's very strong in the church yet.
So that would take a lot of training, not just for bishops and other lay leaders, but for members to know that dynamic maybe should start to play out.
Yes. I think it both takes a lot of training, and I think we need to take a look at the larger cultural realities and meanings in which this is happening. You know, if you listen to conference talks and lessons, there's a high, high value given to obedience and yielding, even mindless yielding, that it's of value, that God's really thinks of it as important in a measure of goodness. And I think that's part of the culture and part of the problem, because it's basically saying you're nothing and so defer. And your deference to those who really understand what's going on is going to protect you. And while I believe that there's a lot of wisdom in a mindful deference to someone who really does understand more and whose judgments you can trust and tolerate deferring to, I think there's value in that, like a doctor or a wise elder who's gone before you and has input. But it's an act of integrity and volition, not just that the deference in and of itself is virtuous. That's a cultural shift, that's a theological and meaning shift that we need to emphasize differently in the church, in my opinion, for us to grow up as a group.
So you deal with sexuality and marriage and young adults, etc. Should these bishops be asking about masturbation?
No, they shouldn't. They shouldn't. I mean, I really...
You hear so many stories of bishops asking 12-year-old girls who have no idea what they're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's problematic on many levels, and I could probably spend a half an hour on this topic alone, but I think that it's problematic to be asking married people for sure, because I think that that's more about adult decisions and choices within the context of the marriage. I think it's problematic to be asking even adolescents, because I certainly understand that there is compulsive sexual behavior, that people can do things that are out of line with their development into healthy, balanced human beings and so on. But I do think we all understand in our hearts that masturbation is a part of normal sexual development on some level. And when we shame it and are so heavy-handed, and then we tell our youth to go to their leadership to get forgiveness, we set in place a fundamental sort of anxiety around sexuality and self-doubt around one's feelings and impulses, and insert the church into that the church is the solution to their defectiveness around very normative behavior. I do believe that we need to shape a healthy understanding, a very clear understanding of what constitutes healthy, loving sexuality, and how you do need to manage impulses towards that end. Even holding our very high standards around sexual behavior, clearly, but still helping people to integrate the normalcy of their sexuality, especially in our theology that's so embracing of the body, and to direct their decisions towards that end, but not in such a shame-based, authority-based, repentance focused around masturbation. That kind of framing really sets up the troubles that we then see people have in marriage, either around deep sexual repression or around kind of sexual compulsivity in terms of pornography and so on. So we need to let go of that, in my opinion.
So I want to circle back to the interviews a little bit. You know, you're a therapist and you meet one-on-one with clients all the time. That's your job. And you're highly trained and skilled at it, which many bishops may not be. But what are best practices that the local LDS leaders could implement that you use or that therapists use?
Like best practices in terms of it, towards what end? Say a little bit more, like if someone is coming in around a concern in their marriage, or maybe help me understand what would be the meaning, the purpose of the meeting, that a best practice would be recommended.
Let's just say that bishops continue to do some one-on-one interviews with people. How can that bishop be trained to have best practices? I think we've covered some of them. Revise the questions. Careful about being too probing. I guess we're talking, I don't know if it's exactly equivalent to therapy. It's more if people come in to talk, that would be more equivalent, right?
Right.
Yes, and that's right. So if someone's coming in to talk about something, I think it's such a challenging question because there's so much to sort of think about what's happening in that dynamic, but I think that if someone's coming in, you want to be a good listener primarily. I mean, you want to understand what it is that they are trying to sort through and what it is they need help with. And then to discern what is the kind of help they might need. Do they need pastoral help or do they need counseling help? Do they need economic help? You know, do they need, what is the thing that they need? And then, am I qualified as the bishop, or if it's a Lee City president or young women's leader or so on, am I qualified to assist them in the complexity of this issue? Because one of the best practices as even a therapist is to know what your limitations are and don't treat beyond your limitations. If you know that you don't have the ability to address sufficiently what the challenge is, then you refer them to someone who can. And that's really an act of strength, and it's very important. So if you think someone's looking for guidance around their relationship with God or their own sense of guilt and they're trying to make something right, understanding it, standing up for their courage and addressing it, but not going into the realm of beyond that, counseling abuse victims, for example. Or, I mean, even to his credit, the bishops of MTC president spoke to his acknowledgement that he was in a situation he ought not to be in, both because of his own limitations, his personal limitations, but also his training limitations, and that there were needs that were far beyond what he could address adequately for the mental health and well-being of those missionaries. And so I think it's just really important to not go beyond what you really are asked to do, which is a pastoral position, not a counseling position, and certainly not an abuse. Certainly words of encouragement, but helping them get to resources that can truly assist them in what's going on.
So one last question or toward the end of this interview. What other suggestions might you have for the church in dealing with the issue of abuse, either of children or adults?
I think that, again, the acknowledgement and recognition that, as they're speaking to now more, is that victims need to be believed. That often the confusion and difficulty of even being able to speak up is so enormous that once someone comes forward, the chances are extremely high that they are telling you exactly what happened, and maybe even less than what has happened. And so taking those claims seriously enough and recognizing, in my opinion, this is a hard recognition, but one that really matters, is how much this kind of abuse happens within families. We want to think of families as the safe haven and the church as the safe haven. And this is where perpetrators, they take advantage of that assumption. They know that they get a pass when they act like a good member of the church. And so then that's where predators like to go. And so this is a Scott Peck quote that he said, at church you can find the best people and the worst people. You find the ones that really are trying to do right, and you find people that take advantage of the assumption that everyone there is trying to do right. And so it's having your eyes open to that, looking for signals of distress in the children, and this would be for primary presidents and young women's and young men's presidents, distress and anxiety both in their home lives or just in general, because these are the other eyes on kids that are often in vulnerable situations that they can't yet speak to or articulate. I did an abuse training in my ward, to a couple of wards in my state, where there had been an incident of a young men's leader molesting the boys at scout camp. And the horrors, because he came across as such a good person and was getting cover by the bishop, who didn't want to see what was really happening, even though the parents kept speaking to it. And so I gave a presentation to a couple of wards, and the person who helped me put it together, we said, we would be more than happy to go to every ward in the state and do the same presentation of how to look for signs in your children and in your church members. But the state presidency just didn't want to do that because I think it felt too negative to them and like it was shining a light on something that they wanted to brush away. And that's a very irresponsible move, in my opinion, because the more informed we are as teachers and parents, the more we can see the signs of distress in victims.
Certainly good advice. And Dr. Finlayson-Fife, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Peggy, thanks. We look forward to your coverage on this topic and others at sltrib.com. And we'll catch you next time on Mormonland.